port of Lorient, Brittany, on the southwest coast of France. Today, a peaceful haven. During World War II, these concrete pens housed one of the most deadly military machines ever created, the Unterseeboot, the German U-boat. From here, U-boats sailed to every corner of the world, wreaking havoc and destruction. Their prime objective, sinking merchant shipping in the Atlantic. U-boats were active from the first day of the war to the last. They posed the greatest threat of all to Allied victory in World War II. The central control room of a Type 7C U-boat, the most prolific of all U-boats. 650 were built. This is the only fully equipped example remaining today. Inside this deadly fighting machine, 44 crew members lived alongside their weapons of war for days on end in cramped and often squalid conditions. 40,000 men went to war in these machines in World War II. 30,000 were to die in their iron coffins. They suffered the highest mortality rate of any fighting unit in the history of war. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill later wrote, "The threat the U-boats posed in the Atlantic was the only thing that ever really frightened me during the war." On their defeat hung the outcome of World War II.
The Battle of the Atlantic was unique in terms of naval operations. What it really was a six-year struggle for control of the sea lines of communications between North America and Great Britain.
This is the man who created and directed Germany's U-boat fleet in World War II. Admiral Karl Dönitz believed that Britain could be defeated by severing those lines of communication. His U-boats would do that by sinking the vessels that brought the vital supplies on which Britain, an island nation, depended for her survival. This was a war about tonnage.
Dönitz, the German submarine commander, believed it was really the only way of bringing Britain to its knees. To start with, it was just a question of sinking as much as it possibly could. Dönitz and his statisticians came to the conclusion that sinking about 600,000 tons of ships a month, and that works out at roughly 100-150 ships a month, they could probably cut the British supply line.
After World War I, the German Navy effectively ceased to exist. They had only begun to rebuild the Navy in the 30s, once Hitler came to power. But at the time war broke out, they really lacked anything like the kind of resources necessary to fight a war with Great Britain. Dönitz had said, "If we have war with Britain, give me 300 U-boats and I'll be able to beat her." When war broke out, he had 57 boats.
These U-boats were already deployed in waters around Britain. It was Dönitz's first move towards severing those vital supply lines with North America. The threat of war hung heavily over Britain, and Americans living there were urged to return home. On September the 3rd, 1939, a few hours before the British declared war on Germany, a passenger ship, the Athenia, sailed from Liverpool for North America. One of the last passengers to board was Kathleen Scher.
I didn't want to leave England. I hated the prospect of the thought that we were going to be in another world war, and yet it seemed inevitable that it was coming.
The Athenia's 1,400 passengers were unaware a U-boat was stalking their liner along the coast of Ireland. Its commander was Fritz Julius Lemp. International rules of engagement forbade him from sinking a civilian ship without first allowing those on board to take to the lifeboats. This ruling did not apply to enemy warships.
He thought that there were camouflage cannon on the ship, and therefore assumed he had a troop ship in front of him. And as a result, he thought an attack was justified.
I was at dinner I had been invited by a ship's officer to sit at his table.
I wanted to experience the first torpedo attack of the war for real. The first shot came smoothly out of the tube, and after a short while came the detonation.
There was this incredible, absolutely incredible explosion. Everything went pitch black. A lot of screaming, a lot of yelling.
Only when we tuned into the merchant shipping frequency in the radio room and received the distress call did we realize that it was the Athenia with 1,400 passengers on board. But by then it was too late.
Ships responded to the Athenia's SOS messages. Kathleen was in an open lifeboat for 9 hours before being rescued.
I remember watching the Athenia turn turtle, and this great hulk rose up into the air and then went down.
Kathleen was lucky. 118 passengers perished. 28 were U.S. citizens. There was international outrage as survivors disembarked in North America. When Lemp returned to Germany, he was secretly ordered to forge his patrol log, removing any reference to the Athenia. This defied every naval convention.
Lemp handwrote 2 pages, making the changes. Then I typed out these notes, and they were added to the official war diary. After that, the whole crew was assembled and put under the strictest oath. It even went as far as forbidding us to reveal anything with a gesture or facial expression. It was also very depressing that the rest of the world knew the truth, but we had to lie about it.
Germany's Minister of Propaganda, Goebbels, blamed Churchill for the sinking of the Athenia, a British plot, he claimed, to lure the United States into the war. In London, reaction to the Athenia tragedy was immediate. Convoying, a system pioneered by the British in World War I, was introduced, in which merchant ships traveled together under armed naval escort. These escorts only operated for 200 miles out into the Atlantic, initially the limit of the U-boat threat. But the Royal Navy were unprepared. They had few escort ships. Also, the Admiralty were dangerously dependent on a system for detecting submarines known as ASDIC. This was an early sonar device, which still lacked range and accuracy. One escort captain who served in the Atlantic right through the war and sank 3 U-boats was Sir Robert Atkinson.
In the early days, we had very little equipment, little training, great enthusiasm, but I would say that is about all. The Germans were much more prepared than we were. We were defending rather than attacking. They had the initiative. We had very untrained merchant seamen, very fine men, but they were not accustomed to convoy duty.
Air protection for the convoys against U-boat attacks was the responsibility of RAF Coastal Command. They were also ill-equipped.
The experience of the First World War was that U-boats were very reluctant to attack any ship or convoy which had air cover. So everything possible was used to give cover to shipping approaching these shores. Such aircraft as we had no means of searching for U-boats other than the pilot's eye. They had no reasonable navigation facilities, and they had no means of attacking a U-boat if they found one.
As Britain faced the realities of a major war and began to build up its fighting resources, one man, early on, was looking to a distant shore for help in the conflict. Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty at the beginning of the war, was already developing relationships with the USA and its president, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He wanted to help his British allies, but faced opposition.
There was a very strong isolationist feeling. It developed partly because of World War I, where there was a group that felt that we had no business entering in the European War. Nevertheless, we did get into it. In World War II, this group was even stronger, and it had control of Congress. It was not a political thing. It was an internal feeling that the war in Europe is not our war, and we should let them fight it out and not involve ourselves.
I'm wishing for the avoidance for my country of the heartbreak that can be America's only reward for participation in another European mess.
Roosevelt had to go forward very, very gradually, never announcing a major change of policy, but simply moving forward step by step in the way of help over armaments and other supplies, and he moved with great circumspection.
His first step was to revise America's Neutrality Act in late 1939, which ended a U.S. embargo on supplying arms to the warring factions. It now allowed trade with them all on a cash-and-carry basis. In reality, this was designed to favor Britain and France because they had control of the sea lanes to America. It was this broad expanse of water along Canada's eastern seaboard that became the main assembly point for getting those vital American goods to Britain. Canadian support for Britain's fight against Hitler had been absolute from day one of the war, and the deep water port of Halifax, Nova Scotia, was of critical importance.
It was the central port on the Atlantic coast from which convoys were formed up for the long trek across the treacherous Atlantic to Great Britain. The term escort can apply either to the individual warship or to a screen consisting of a number of warships. And the principle of convoy protection was really the safe and timely arrival of the convoy. And that means that the escort would really not want to leave that convoy to go chasing after submarines. And that's why quite frequently escort commanders did not have a high number of submarine kills, because their duty was to press the submarine down, that is, keep it underwater where it was out of contact with the convoy, moving more slowly. It was not the submarines killed which was important for the escort. It was the amount of shipping safely transported across the ocean.
This was the U-boat that terrorized those North Atlantic convoys, the Type 7C. A submersible, rather than a submarine, it traveled on the surface for 90% of the time. With a maximum speed of over 17 knots from its twin diesel engines, it could outpace many of the defending escort ships. But when it submerged and became dependent on its electric motors for propulsion, its speed was halved.
The Type 7C was that which Dönitz personally preferred because they were most suited for convoy battles in the North Atlantic. They were very maneuverable, especially underwater, and that was something that Dönitz considered very important. They would spend a patrol of perhaps 4 to 5 weeks in the North Atlantic, engaged in convoy operations. The commanders of Type 7Cs tended to be younger men, and the Type 7s themselves embodied the virtues of younger commanders. More energetic, more prone to the offensive, greater optimism. All these are reflected in the use of the Type 7C.
The Type 7C brought immediate success, and the era of the U-boat aces began. Only 2 weeks into the war, Otto Schuart sank the British carrier Courageous. 500 died. 3 weeks later, Gunter Priam and his crew, in a daring raid against the British Grand Fleet moored at Scapa Flow, sank the battleship Royal Oak. 800 died. It was a propaganda coup. Priam and his men were the toast of Germany. In Berlin, they were awarded Iron Crosses, and Priam addressed the nation.
Wir haben uns durchgemogelt durch die Überwachung und waren 40 drin. Drin im Hafen von Scapa Flow, die im Hafen der englischen Firma.
Where Ace Priam led, others followed. The most celebrated U-boat commander of all, the Tonnage King, was Otto Kretschmer. He sank 38 Allied ships.
My father had been an officer in World War I. As boys, my brother and myself were taught that the most important thing for a man in Germany is a high sense of duty. Not only normal duty, but also everything beyond the normal call of duty.
Kretschmer had trained in the 1930s and learned the orthodox tactics for launching a U-boat attack. This meant firing a spread of three torpedoes into the convoy from outside at a distance. Practical experience taught him there was a more effective method of attack. He devised his own close form of engagement, taking his U-boat inside the convoy. He first tested it on a training exercise.
I tried out my new tactics, going past the escorts, very close to the target, and firing a torpedo at point-blank range, and not a spread from outside. And these escorts at the training establishment, they were so clever, they knew everything, how to defend a target and against submarine attack. If I succeeded with them, I shall succeed in the Atlantic against enemy escorts who have come out across the Atlantic maybe and are in stress and strain.
Hiding beneath the surface by day, Kretschmer would launch his torpedo attacks on the surface at night. With the cover of darkness and firing his torpedoes close into the target, he was harder to locate. He would carefully select the most valuable victims and apply his philosophy of one torpedo, one ship. Volmar Koenig served under the command of Kretschmer in his boat U-99 and witnessed firsthand the ace in action.
Lieutenant Commander Kretschmer was very intelligent and shrewd. He had developed the tactics of going into the convoy on the surface to the utmost. You have to be very, very cold-blooded to do this. All the lights on and the burning tankers and searchlights, and you stay on the surface. You don't dodge. That's very important. And he did this to perfection.
Kretschmer became a national hero, and the army even wrote a march in his honor.
They called it Kretschmer March, and it was attended to me at the ceremony. I had to make a speech, which I never liked to do, a speech of thanks. And gave to the regimental commander a life belt of the tanker Conch, which I had just sank in the Atlantic.
It was the heyday of the aces. Between June and August 1940, a handful of U-boats sank over 150 Allied merchant ships. The German occupation of France, after its surrender in June 1940, had transformed the U-boat war. Dönitz was now able to establish bases along the southwest coast of France, giving his U-boats ready access to the Atlantic convoy lanes. He set up his operational headquarters in this chateau, close to the port of Lorient, where he could watch his U-boats come and go. From this underground bunker, he personally directed all operations. Hans Fuhrmann was his adjutant.
While I was there, the biggest problem was the number of U-boats. We only had about 40 to 50 U-boats. That was quite a lot, but of those U-boats, a third were always in transit, going out or coming back. A third would be lying in dock for repairs and refitting, and only a third were really out there in the Atlantic trying to attack the enemy.
If the number of operational boats was critical to the success of Dönitz's Atlantic offensive, so were the crews that manned them. The majority were volunteers, intensively trained, and attracted to an elite service, where pay was double that of the regular Navy.
Dönitz once described a U-boat crew as a community bound by fate. Any one failing, could mean death for all 50 men. Therefore, a crew felt very much bound to each other and loyalty to each other in a sense that I don't think any other warship represents. Over 50% of the U-boat crews came from central Germany, where industry had taken hold in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Well over half the U-boat crews had come from the metalworking fields of industry. to the German Navy, which meant that they were used to dealing with tubes, pipes, electricity, various forms of metal working and metal shaping, all of which were invaluable skills aboard a naval vessel. These were working class kids.
They were proud of their success. Returning from patrol, they would fly a pennant for each ship sunk. By the end of 1940, they had sunk one-fifth of Britain's merchant fleet. They called it the happy time. The ambition of every captain was to sink 100,000 tons of shipping and gain a Knight's Cross.
What was important to us, whether we had a good skipper or not, it could mean life or death. Fortunate enough to sail under a good skipper. He was a very reasonable man. He was aggressive and yet cautious. He didn't take any unnecessary chances. And he was only 23 years old. Always ceremonies when we left, and there were ceremonies when we returned. Of course, we slowly approached the pier, and there were lots of people standing on the pier welcome us. The base commander came, and the officers attended and officially welcome us back from a mission. If a captain had Halsschmerzen, that meant that he had a sore throat, and he was going to decorate his throat with a Knight's Cross. And of course, in the process of doing so, he might take some more chances that the crew wasn't always all that enthusiastic about. And the band always played a certain song, and we liked it very much. We were singing, "Now we dive into the foaming beer, because 518 got its ass on the pier." Later on, much later on, when I came to the United States, I found out that that song was Stars and Stripes Forever. Well, of course, we got ashore, the drinks and the beer in particular, it tasted very good because there was no drinking on the submarine. And of course, there were the pleasures of the flesh. They loaded us into a bus and took us to the next town and led us out near the bordellos that were there, and we frequented the prostitutes and make up for lost time. Didn't take us long to catch up, however. We had our own special train that ran from the western coast of France all the way back to Germany, to Hamburg, and it was a very comfortable train. But that was one of those little privileges that we had.
The relationship between Admiral Dönitz and his men in the U-Waffe, or the submarine service, can perhaps best be described as personal. He identified his submarines as his submarines and his men as his men. He made a point of personal contact with his commanding officers. He knew the crews. He epitomized for them what it meant to be a submariner and a member of a very special elite crew.
Kaplan Hofmeister, meiner Mutter das U-Boot Kriegsabzeichen zu erreichen. Kämpfen heißt opfern und siegen. Der Kampf geht weiter.
The basis of Dönitz's philosophy was an idea which had started very late in World War I. The idea was to use not single submarines, but submarines in groups. Submarine command normally had no aircraft for reconnaissance. The submarines had to reconnoiter themselves.
The U-boats were positioned in the Atlantic in so-called reconnaissance lines. But there were several U-boats stationed at various points within a particular area where they could keep a watchful eye on the traffic flow, and when a U-boat sighted a convoy, it then sent a radio signal giving the precise coordinates of the convoy, how many knots it was doing, and how many ships there were. Then all the other U-boats would mount a combined attack on the convoy, and we call that the wolf pack strategy. U-boats never operated alone. Rather, 5, 6, or 7 boats, if available, would pounce on the convoy simultaneously.
It was first called group tactics. About the end of the year 1939, I got into a train and entered the restaurant car. I saw Dönitz with some other officers sitting there for dinner. Dönitz said the submarine force really needed a slogan. And then he took his table napkin and put down some words. U-Boote sind die Wölfe zur See, angreifen, reißen, versenken. U-Boots are the wolves at sea, attack, tear, sink.
A submarine is a killing machine, and it's a weapon. And the people serving on a submarine are eager for success. You spot the ship, you spot the convoy, and you fire the torpedo. And you look at the stopwatch and say, well, by now it should have hit the torpedo. Suddenly it gives a big bang. It's like, well, it's a hit. And you are proud of success, and you don't think of the poor people. You don't think so. And you don't see the subject you are shooting at. Perhaps the captain does, to the periscope, or the people on the bridge if you are fighting above the surface. It's impersonal. It's a fighting machine, and you are part of the machine, a little wheel. And you don't think of these consequences. It might be bad, but that's the way it is.
The merchant seamen who sailed out from Liverpool and other British ports were the unsung heroes of the Battle of the Atlantic. Drawn from all nationalities, they put their lives on the line to transport the vital supplies from North America. 30,000 paid the ultimate price.
Well, to be torpedoed is a very horrifying experience. Now, depending on what type of merchant ship you're on, if you're loaded with explosives and you're hit with a torpedo, there's one big explosion. The ship disintegrates, and there's usually no survivors. If you're on a tanker, particularly loaded with aviation gas or high-octane gas, there's a big ball of flame after being struck with a torpedo, just conflagration. And again, there's very, very few survivors.
I always slept with my clothes on. I always had my boots where I could grab them. I always had my life jacket. Most of the time slept with it, even washed with it. When I used to do the dishes, I used to take them out on the deck and lay them on the water, pans of water on the hatch, top of the hatch, and wash them there. And they used to say, why are you doing that? And I used to say, well, if we get hit, I want to be outside where I won't get jammed.
We were in the part of the ship which is almost impossible to escape from under conditions of being torpedoed. The engine room, of course, being the focal point of any torpedo attack, being the most vulnerable part of a ship in order to disable it, we felt very keenly our exposure down there. Really, we felt that if we were ever torpedoed on watch, we really didn't have a chance to escape.
I've seen many, many ships sunk. In fact, we're so close to some of them, sometimes you'd feel the heat from them. And these men were in the water, oily water, and crude oil, and black bunker. And we were not allowed to stop to pick up survivors. That was a very strict rule the Navy made, that you were not to stop under any circumstances. So it's pretty bad when you know there's people in the water there hollering for help, and there's not a blessed thing you can do about it.
There's one ship designated to pick up survivors, and if that ship found you before you died exposed from exposure, you're probably saved. If not, you're just another casualty in the North Atlantic.
In the heart of London, at Churchill's secret underground headquarters, the crippling loss of ships, supplies, and lives was painfully apparent. There was a desperate need for additional escort ships to help protect the convoys. One of Churchill's first acts as Prime Minister was to ask Roosevelt for assistance. A deal was finally struck. In return for leases on 8 Caribbean islands, Britain got 50 Great War American destroyers. An unequal exchange, many said. The ships were in poor shape, But for the first time, it meant an open, official U.S. commitment to Britain's cause. 6 months later, Roosevelt came to the rescue in decisive manner when Britain no longer had the cash to pay for its American supplies.
Roosevelt had to come up with a different means of helping his ally, Winston Churchill, and it was the Lend-Lease Bill. Now, this was an act whereby the United States agreed to give Britain all it needed in raw materials, weapons, fuel, and food in order to keep that island nation alive. And the Lend-Lease Bill was made palatable to many by the wonderful image that was created by President Franklin Roosevelt when he said, "It is like a man whose neighbor's house is on fire and he lends him his garden hose."
The Lend-Lease Bill meant Britain could draw on American war supplies without having to pay cash. Above all, it guaranteed a supply of cargo vessels to challenge Dönitz's declared goal of sinking Allied merchant ships more rapidly than they could be replaced. In the spring of 1941, the U-boat arm suffered one of its first major setbacks. Two of Dönitz's greatest aces, Schepke and Prien, set out for the last time. Their boats were sunk in the Atlantic, and neither commander survived. On the same patrol, Otto Kretschmer's boat was mortally damaged by the British destroyer HMS Walker and its crew forced into the water. Volmar Koenig was there.
And there I was, and clinging to this scrambling net. But I was too numb to do anything, so the British sailors came over the side, down the net, and put me up to the deck.
Of course, I had a life jacket on, and the mermaids couldn't pull me down. I recovered myself on the surface again and followed my crew, the rest of my crew, which was taken up out of the water by HMS Walker.
Kretschmer's capture ended the era of the individual aces and marked a change in the direction of the U-boat war. Henceforward, Dönitz switched almost entirely to group tactics, wolf packs operating further and further out into the mid-Atlantic. His operational base in France was also expanding. Construction of the huge U-boat pens at Lorient was underway. With their massive reinforced concrete walls, they provided a secure haven against British bombing raids. And from shipyards all over Germany poured the boats to fill them. In 1941, Dönitz's fleet doubled, but expansion brought problems.
As the U-boat fleet expanded so dramatically from 1940 to 1942, Dönitz had to cut corners in training his commanders, in training his crews. He knew that in order to provide the strongest possible force to fight the convoy battles in the North Atlantic, he had to compromise on their training. Younger, less experienced, less well-trained commanders might not possess the kind of insight into how to attack a convoy. To compensate for that shortcoming, Dönitz assumed on himself the need to control operations, to direct a convoy battle from his headquarters.
But one of the prime characteristics of the direction of the submarine war in the Battle of the Atlantic was radio communications. And Admiral Dönitz would constantly have radio contact with his ships. He was conducting war on their behalf, directing them towards certain convoys, directing them towards certain task groups, demanding that they submit weather reports, whatever the case might be. In fact, he was known to have sent a lot of signals which, from a purely operational tactical point of view, were utterly superfluous. And sometimes it seemed as though he himself really didn't understand the risks he was asking his commanders to undertake. Frequently in replying to these signals, the submariners were exposing themselves needlessly to danger.
British naval intelligence knew in World War I everything about the position of German U-boats, because also of the radio chatter. They took bearings, they knew where they were.
Locating the position of the enemy by tuning into his radio signals had been written about in an obscure English publication in 1931. Kretschmer had discovered this book during his midshipman training and not forgotten its lessons.
Some of the chapters gave me so much information about submarine war. First of all, not to use radio, to keep radio silence, and know how efficient British naval intelligence was.
In a leafy suburb 50 miles north of London lay hidden one of the most powerful and secret weapons of World War II, the British government's communications headquarters at Bletchley Park. Their highest priority was to crack the German naval code. This machine lay at the heart of that code. Every U-boat had one. It ciphered and deciphered all the secret messages that passed between Dönitz and his U-boats. It was considered impregnable. The British called it Enigma.
The German cryptologists had taken their steps to protect their messages with the very invention of the Enigma cipher system. The number of combinations was, it has recently been calculated, greater than the number of atoms in the known universe, and would have taken many more eons than the universe has been in existence to come up with a possible correct answer.
Inside this Edwardian mansion, the Bletchley Park codebreakers began the seemingly impossible task of trying to break the Enigma cyber system. At the beginning of the war, 70 people worked here. That number was to grow to 12,000.
The people at Bletchley Park were mostly intellectuals. Many of them were expert chess players, mathematicians, linguists, and a few professional cryptographers. It's important to understand that the breaking of the German naval enigma was a much more difficult problem than the breaking of the German Air Force or Army enigma. The reason was that the German naval enigma was set up by keying books, which told you which order the rotor should be put in and where their starting positions were and a number of the other keying variables. It wasn't possible, really, to crack the enigma without the knowledge of the keying variables organized in this book. In the middle of 1941, Harry Hinsley, a young undergraduate, had the idea that it might be possible to capture some of the keying books from some German weather ships, which were isolated to the northeast of Iceland.
The Germans were keeping weather trawlers up among the icebergs. We knew their position. And most important of all, though this was a guess on my part, that they carried the Enigma. And with that information, the Admiralty went and captured a trawler. It was a stroke of fortune that the Germans had the Enigma in those little ships, little fishing ships. It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe my eyes when I thought, well, they've got the Enigma. I could hardly believe myself. But they had. That was an amazing, amazing stroke of luck.
Further treasures were about to be recovered from the Atlantic to help the codebreakers crack the Enigma system. U-110, under the command of Fritz Julius Lemp, who sank the Athenia on the first day of the war, was blown to the surface by Royal Navy Escort Group. For David Baum, it was to be the most important day of his life.
Well, I was the sub-lieutenant, aged 20, in HMS Bulldog, which was the leader of a third escort group in the Atlantic. We were there, and Obrecia, and HMS Broadway, an old American destroyer which had been given to us. We all opened fire with all our guns on U-110, the object being to rattle the crew to get them to abandon ship.
Lemp saw a destroyer tearing directly towards us. One of the destroyers was the Bulldog, and the other one was the Broadway. At the last moment, the Broadway got an order from the Bulldog to abort the ramming.
Abzusetzen, Captain Baker Kressel, Captain of the Bulldog, shouted through the megaphone, don't ram, because he wanted to preserve U-110. Just stop Broadway from ramming her.
Do you see
her? Aborting the ramming at the last minute was fatal for us because Lemp had assumed that they would cut us in half, so everyone had to get out. And in this situation, he of course shouted down, "Get out, out, out!" And when we radio operators asked, "What about the secret papers and so on?" he said, "Leave it all in there, get out, out, out." He tried to save the life of every single man. When we were in the water and the boat didn't sink, then it was too late to do anything about it.
We could see Obrisha was told to pick up all survivors. They picked up all the German crew, popped them down below immediately, so they couldn't see what was going on. And my captain ordered a armed boarding party and told me to take charge of it.
They rowed over to the stricken sub, with David at the helm, not knowing whether demolition charges had been set or German crew members were still on board. David courageously went down inside the submarine ahead of his team.
The hatch going down below was closed. I don't know why it was closed, but it was closed. I opened it up. Didn't seem to be anybody there, so I went down. But there was a very vulnerable moment there, because bottom first, with both hands on the ladder, vertical ladder, revolver holstered, and I was a sitting target for anybody down below. I looked both ends of the ship. You could see through, right through to the battery room, the engine room, and then up forward to torpedo compartments. And didn't seem to be anybody on board at all. Very eerie, no, absolutely silent, except for the flopping of the waves against the hull. So I then shouted up, got the crew down, and then we started ransacking the place, all the books and the charts and absolute mess of code books, signal books, cipher books, everything we could find. We passed up and into a relief boat. Captain had sent a motorboat over from the Broadway, and that took all the gear.
But what happened to Lemp, last seen by his crew in the water? It's widely believed he tried to reboard his U-boat in a desperate effort to sink it, and was shot by the boarding party from Bulldog.
I know from time to time it's said that my boarding party shot Lemp. There's absolutely no truth whatsoever in this. None of us fired a single shot, and we didn't see the survivors. They'd been picked up or were being picked up the other side of the U-boat. And I think Lemp must have realised that the U-boat wasn't sinking. He may have seen us going over in the boat. And thinking of his past too, when he'd sunk the Athenia, which was quite a controversial matter. And I think he probably felt this is really it, letting my boat be boarded, not sinking it. And he probably just committed suicide in the water.
David's cryptographic treasures from U-110 were rushed to Bletchley, and together with the seizures from the weather ships, the codebreakers were now able to crack the Enigma ciphers. It was one of the outstanding achievements of World War II. The British were soon reading the secret messages that passed between Dönitz and his U-boats as rapidly as the Germans themselves.
We began to read regularly the U-boat ciphers, and we read it without fail every day. The use of the Enigma, the fact that it was so regular, so current, meant that we were more or less able to route the convoys away from U-boat positions.
The pendulum in the Battle of the Atlantic had swung for the moment in Britain's favour. By mid-1941, the convoys were getting through with reduced losses. And the United States, though technically still neutral, was playing an ever-increasing role in ensuring those vital war supplies reached British shores.
We were in the war against the German U-boats, helping England, long before the United States technically declared war. I know I was there. I was in a destroyer. We convoyed across the Atlantic Ocean. We escorted across all the way to Iceland from the United States. Some of our fellows escorted all the way to within 100 miles of the shore of England.
By placing United States naval vessels in the convoy lanes and directly protecting the ships, the freighters and the tankers that were carrying goods to Great Britain, the United States was engaged in warlike activity.
So we were in action. Our orders were to fight back. President Roosevelt declared first that everything on a certain line in the middle of the Atlantic was on our side. Later he extended that line closer to Europe and finally declared the entire Atlantic Ocean an American lake.
It must be said that most people then and most people now do not know that the United States issued war orders in July of 1941, 6 months before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The orders were issued by Admiral Ernest J. King, who is Commander-in-Chief of the United States Atlantic Fleet. This was a direct action for the United States Navy to go to war. On September 4th, a destroyer, the USS Greer, had an exchange of fire with a U-boat at sea. Both missed. There was no damage done to either side, but the exchange of fire that everybody had worried about had taken place.
The following month, the destroyer Kearney was torpedoed and 11 seamen died. American blood had joined the Atlantic War.
Our American merchant ships must be armed to defend themselves against the rattlesnakes of the sea.
Even as Roosevelt spoke, one of those rattlesnakes, U-552, was hunting its prey in the Atlantic.
Our American merchant ships must be free to carry our American goods into the harbors of our friends.
In command of U-552 was Erich Topp, one of Dönitz's greatest aces.
And our American merchant ships must be protected by our American Navy. It can never be doubted that the goods will be delivered by this nation whose Navy believes in the tradition of damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
4 days after Roosevelt's speech, Topp torpedoed the American destroyer Reuben James. It was the first U.S. Navy vessel to be lost in World War II. Two-thirds of the ship's company died.
As far as I was concerned, the Reuben James was a British destroyer protecting a British convoy. And therefore, I had no qualms about attacking her. Several days later, I heard on American radio that an American destroyer, the Reuben James, had been sunk. And I realized just how politically explosive this matter was. 110 lives were lost in this catastrophe. And you could say they were murdered in the most horrific way imaginable. People were swimming around in oil, on fire. It was appalling. At least two-thirds of the crew. I was haunted by this image, and I spent days and nights thinking about it, unable to change what had happened. From my point of view, I felt guilty that I might have started a war with the Americans.
Topp did not, but the Japanese did. Out of the blue Hawaiian skies, 5 weeks later, they rained devastation on the American battle fleet at Pearl Harbor, sinking or seriously damaging 18 ships and killing over 2,000.
Overnight, after December 7, 1941, the entire American nation rose up in wrath against the Japanese. But there was no commitment in Congress to declare war against Nazi Germany. It took Germany to declare war on us to bring us into war with that power. And many people think that next to Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941, this was his biggest mistake. On December 11th, 4 days after Pearl Harbor, Hitler unilaterally, gratuitously, with no sound reason, declared war against the United States.
But that declaration of war against the USA, far from creating despondency in the U-boat arm, was celebrated.
There was great elation in the German Navy because for months they had had to fight with an arm tied behind their back against the American destroyers that were escorting British convoys across the Atlantic east and west. Now, the commanders were free to launch torpedoes at every warship they saw in the Atlantic. There was no holding back because of the Americans. Dönitz secured permission from Hitler to go ahead and plan an attack along the east shore of the United States, from Maine to Florida, in an operation that Dönitz called Paukenschlag, drumbeat. Now, Admiral Dönitz thought that his U-boats would have no problem with the United States Navy because they were untrained and unprepared, and in Dönitz's view, and certainly that of Hitler too, the United States Navy was unprofessional. The German High Command had a very poor regard for the American fighting man, did not think that the American had the stomach for a fight, did not think that the Americans would be able effectively to turn back those U-boats to bloody their noses. Rather thought that the U-boats would bloody the American Navy's noses. And they were right. It was the greatest maritime disaster in modern times. It was the greatest defeat at sea suffered by the United States Navy in World War II. It was an Atlantic Pearl Harbor.
January 1942, and in those sunny states along America's east coast and southern shores, the living was easy. For vacationers, the war in Europe that the United States had entered just 3 weeks before seemed a long way away. At night, the coastal neon burned brightly. From New York to Florida and down into the Gulf of Mexico, life was still carefree. The bloody conflict in Europe, a distant newspaper headline. Americans were unaware that just a few miles off their shores lurked one of the world's most potent military forces poised to strike against their country. Hitler's U-boats had arrived on the American seaport.
Vessel after vessel went down from Maine to Florida, into the Gulf of Mexico and through the islands of the Caribbean, all waters protected by the United States Navy. The German U-boat fleet had its way with the American coastal waters. In what has to be reckoned one of the greatest maritime disasters of all time, it was certainly the greatest defeat at sea suffered by the United States Navy in World War II. By the time that the United States finally got a grip on this situation, almost 400 ships had been sunk, with the loss of about 5,000 lives.
Admiral Dönitz, head of German U-boats, had devised a daring attack on American coastal shipping, which was implemented 10 days after Germany declared war on the United States. Five U-boats were readied and secret orders issued to their commanders.
We left Loyang on the 23rd of December, 41, and I want to leave before Christmas because I don't want to have drunken sailors on board. And on Christmas Eve, we submerged, and then we made a German Christmas. We had Christmas trees on board and parcels for every man of the crew. I read the Christmas story of Lucas number 2, and we were singing Christmas chorals and so on. We had a special good dinner. And for some hours, the war was very far off. It was the most impressive Christmas Eve I had in my life.
Hardigan set course for America, 3,000 miles away, in his Type 9 U-boat. Four others followed him.
I had the order to go to New York and to be there on the 12th of January and not to attack our ships.
They were to strike all at once on the same day against targets of opportunity. They were not to operate as a wolf pack, but to operate independently, to find targets, hold off, and then on January 13, strike at once in an operation that Dönitz called Haukenschlag, drumbeat. Haukenschlag meaning the sudden beat of a drumstick against the tympanum or drumhead of a drum.
We had no charts of the American coast. I had no navigation aids at all, because if Dönitz would have all our charts of East Coast of New York, maybe one spy remarked it, and then the enemy would have known that John Submarine wants to go to the East Coast of the United States. And so I had only a small atlas von Knauer of the American coast. There was only a small plan of New York, and that was all.
Unknown to him and to the other four U-boat commanders as they made their way west across the Atlantic was the fact that the British Admiralty in London was reading all of their radio traffic to and from Admiral Dönitz. And they were able to plot the position, course, and speed of each of the boats day by day. And they gave all of that information to the United States Navy. The documents and the daily situation maps of the United States Navy itself show just how detailed U.S. knowledge was of the approach of that fleet. And yet, when the fleet arrived, the United States Navy did nothing. The 21 destroyers that had been harbored by Admiral King, the chief of the entire United States Navy, for the purpose of resisting a German invasion fleet if it should come, were not sent out for that duty at all. The lights were all left on so that the German U-boats could silhouette their targets easily against coastal cities. The lighthouses, the buoys were all lit up. It's as though the United States was not at war.
When I came to New York, I saw the lights of Coney Island, of the amusement park, and it was all full light.
During that successful week, we were operating there. We saw cars driving along the coast road. We were so close we could smell the forest from where we were.
It was like a deep peacetime, and that was amazing for me, and we were very astonished. Afterwards, when I learned that Admiral Ernest J. King knew that we came, it is much more amazing for me that he did nothing.
I think that we'd have 15 to 20 ships in sight at any given time, because they'd all be showing their navigation lights. And we could more or less pick and choose which ship we wanted to attack next. For us, this was totally unexpected. If you compare it with the way the U-boats had to fight in the North Atlantic or elsewhere against stronger and stronger defensive forces.
In the Canadian waters, where two of the U-boats of Drumbeat were assigned, those U-boats were so harried by Royal Canadian destroyers and aircraft that they were forced out of Canadian waters and fled south to the more benign waters of the United States. But the U.S. Navy did precious little but to twiddle its thumbs and to watch a carnage develop, the like of which had never happened in American waters in modern times. If you take all five of the U-boats, they sank 25 ships on that one Operation Haukenschlag, Operation Drumbeat.
After 3 weeks, the five successful U-boats returned to Lorient in France, the U-boat's operational headquarters. Dönitz's goal of severing U.S.-British supply lines had taken a dramatic step forward with Hardigan's American success. Hardigan was a hero.
Well, that was a very big welcome. I had 10 pendants on my periscope from the United States. There were a lot of people, nice girls came with flowers and kissed me and so on. It was very nice. Dönitz came on board and he gave me the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross on my neck. And then there was a guard of honor, and I had to pass this guard of honor. There were always a nice welcome, but this welcome was a special big one.
We were the first of the five boats to return from the mission to the U.S. coast. So the propaganda made a great feature of it. I recall not liking that very much, I have to say honestly, because we hadn't encountered any resistance. And we had been successful without having really been attacked in any way by the enemy. That's why my feelings were a bit mixed.
Kapitän Lieutenant Hardegen was seen as a man who could go with impunity, which in fact was largely true, right up to the North American coast. It was the best choice for Admiral Dönitz to move his chess pieces into an area where they were safe, where they could have a high toll for their armament, where they could pin down a great number of forces, and also destabilize Allied operations.
The U-boat that underpinned these long-distance operations was the Type 9. This is the last remaining one in the world.
A Type 9C would average more than 100 days at sea for each patrol. They did not operate in packs, but typically individually, as lone wolves. And usually they operated against independently routed ships in more distant zones where there were no escorts. And the commanders of these boats tended to be older men who embodied the virtues of maturity. Commanders would be on their own to make up their decisions about what kind of targets they could attack or avoid. Discretion was also an important part of being a Type 9 commander because the Type 9 boats were more vulnerable. Being larger, it took longer for them to dive. They were more sluggish, would have much more trouble eluding anti-submarine weapons used underwater. Although the Type 9s never represented more than 12% of the total U-boat fleet, they nevertheless accomplished 37% of all the sinkings achieved by German U-boats during the war, which is a reflection of the fact that U-boats really operated best against unprotected individual ships. As soon as they were up against convoys, it was a very different story.
Extra torpedoes were loaded for these long-distance operations, and meticulous attention was paid to provisioning. Each Type 9 was totally self-sufficient.
Now, when we left port, of course, we used every little nook and corner to stash provisions in there. And you see some of the provisions hanging from the so-called ceiling. The hams, the sausages hanging there. Crates on the bottom with eggs and lemons, potatoes. That was all fresh food that we needed to eat first before we went to the canned goods.
The potatoes tasted of diesel oil. Everything tasted of diesel and of the stench in the submarine, which was the smell of diesel oil, the crew's sweat, and the toilets. This was a potent mixture which formed a deposit on the food. When the crew was back on land again, the food didn't really taste of anything because the stench wasn't there.
Frankly, personal hygiene was non-existent. We didn't pay too much attention to it. Of course, we had no bathing facilities, except occasionally we could turn on a water hose and rinse ourselves down with salt water, with seawater. We couldn't do that very often. The opportunity just didn't arise. We were issued perfume, by the gallons almost. And we took that along. That was supposed to relieve the odor a little. And a substitute for water, we rubbed ourselves down with perfume. And it was called 4711. It was a very, very famous perfume. Of course, we didn't use that much of it. We preferred to take it home to our mothers and girlfriends. It was a neat present. To this day, I really can't stand the smell of 4711.
Following Group Hardigan's initial attack on America, Dönitz sent successive waves of his U-boats against the unprotected merchant shipping passing through American coastal waters. These onslaughts also met with massive success and minimal opposition as they headed further south.
Texas had become a major oil producer, and since petroleum products were so vitally important in the war effort, the German Navy soon realized that the amounts of petroleum products coming out of the Galveston, Houston, Texas City area were vital. They then decided to come and make the attacks in the Gulf because almost half the oil in the United States was coming out of this little area. The first four or five sinkings were reported in the newspapers. Then, suddenly, the news stopped any reports of the sinkings altogether. All in all, in the almost 2 years they were in the Gulf, they sank 56 ships and damaged 14 more, which made a total of 70 ships. That was a major victory that people are unaware of to this day.
Two lifetime friends meet to reminisce. One of the most daring attacks on American shipping took place just off the Florida coast near Jacksonville. It was experienced by Phil May and Vernon Townsend.
Phil May and I had dates with two of our classmates in high school. We drove to the beach, went to the boardwalk, which had Ferris wheels, merry-go-rounds, and so forth.
We were riding on the merry-go-round, and I remember coming around facing the ocean and looking, just, you know, you're looking out at the ocean anyhow, and all of a sudden, here's this gigantic ball of fire right straight out in front of us.
Within 30 seconds, somebody said, U-boat.
Commander of that U-boat was Reinhard Hardigan, his prey, the Gulf America.
Off St. Augustine, I saw a big tanker and torpedoed her, and she was burning very hard, and I wanted to finish her with my gun.
As the fire was blazing, I could actually see the outline of the deck gun on the submarine and the conning tower as they fired. It was a very dramatic sight.
And it was very intimidating to realize that they could have turned their guns toward us, which they did not.
I went around the ship because I thought if I would shell her from the seaside, maybe if one shell will miss the ship, I will hit a hotel or innocent people ashore. It was difficult for me because my boat was silhouetted against a burning tanker, and I had no opportunity to escape if a destroyer or a gunboat will suddenly come, because in shallow water I cannot dive, I cannot submerge.
We had read about the war in Europe, but this was the first time we had seen the war. And we were dumbstruck that anyone would do that so close to the United States.
I just could not believe the war had come right to our front door. And, you know, at 16 years old, I thought, my gosh, you know, we are really in the war.
19 men died that night in the burning oil, almost half the tanker's crew. This tragedy forced Admiral King to halt oil tanker traffic on the American East Coast for a month. As U-boat attacks on American coastal shipping escalated, so did public alarm.
The public, I think, became more and more paranoid about the U-boat operations. An air of suspicion prevailed. The FBI even had people in Galveston spying upon each other to report who went in and out of certain houses. People were afraid that there were some people sending out secret messages to the U-boats. because no one could figure out how they knew where the ships were. It was all a very mysterious thing. And people were looking for Germans to come to shore in rubber dinghies. They even thought that they had come and snuck in sometimes and gone to the movies and had bought groceries. People were also afraid of possible sabotage. They thought that the enemy was going to sneak ashore and blow up the refineries and all of these petrochemical plants, which were highly explosive, that existed right there close to Galveston. There was just a lot of fear of the unknown.
The fear of German landings on American beaches was not misplaced. In early summer 1942, at this spot on Pontevedra Beach, Florida, the nightmare became a reality. Four Nazi saboteurs were put ashore by U-boat. They slipped inland under cover of darkness. They were to rendezvous with four other enemy agents who had made a simultaneous U-boat landing at Amagansett on Long Island. This was Operation Pastorius, a Nazi plot to blow up American industrial plants, damage war production, and achieve a devastating propaganda coup for the Third Reich. In these dunes, they buried cases of explosives and detonators before heading for New York. The plot was swiftly betrayed by two of its members, although FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover claimed the credit for their capture. Their cache of explosives in the Florida dunes was dug up by FBI agents, and the conspirators were tried by a hastily convened military commission in Washington. Within weeks, the two informants were jailed, and their six fellow spies executed at 14-minute intervals, the fastest multiple electrocutions in American history. To protect America, the Coast Guard formed beach patrols. In Texas, they took to the saddle.
We patrolled the beach at night, horseback, and to start with, they gave us shotguns, and we didn't have any shells for a month or two. We started out riding our own horses, and later on, the ships and crazy horses that never had been ridden. It was quite a show for a while till we got them trained. We ride about 15, 20 miles a night back and forth along the beach. We were told to look for spies that probably the U-boats had put out to come ashore to sabotage Beaumont or Port Arthur, the refineries, and any lights or anything that might be out in the Gulf.
While the Coast Guard prepared to repel enemy landings, the U.S. Navy failed to sink a single U-boat in the 3 months following the launch of Operation Drumbeat. It was all too easy for U-boat aces like Erich Topp.
They were unprepared for it. The security forces were untrained, and they hadn't established a convoy system. So to that extent, it was child's play. And all the commanders who took part launched up huge successes there. It was obvious that the Americans were not prepared for war.
Commander Erich Topp returned home from America to a rapturous dockside welcome. Dönitz's bold initiative against U.S. coastal shipping and the overwhelming success of his U-boat men in their strikes at the heart of the enemy had not gone unnoticed by German high command. Reinhard Hardegen and Erich Topp were summoned to Hitler's headquarters in East Prussia to receive the Führer's personal congratulations and the addition of oak leaf clusters to their Knight's crosses. German success spelt disaster for merchant seamen. Sailing in American waters had become a hazardous undertaking, especially for tanker crews.
We were running coastwise much of the time up to New York from down here in Texas. Cape Hatteras seemed to be the big bugaboo. Up there it seemed like a kind of a junction point for everybody to go to Europe or go to New York or Boston, and the submarines seemed to hang out right around Cape Hatteras, which was known as Torpedo Alley. Most of the time we got in that area while we'd all be wearing our life jackets and being prepared to abandon ship at any time, because it just took just a few minutes when a tanker got hit to the whole thing would be enveloped in fire and it'd be just a terrible situation. And you're going to abandon ship while they had these life rafts that would just slide off by gravity. And all somebody had to do was just cut the line and the raft would go floating off, and it was made up of barrels and planks. Our company had two boats that were sunk in the Gulf of Mexico, but we really didn't realize how bad it was until the war came to an end.
Surprisingly, the U.S. Navy was very slow in putting into effect the convoy system, which had worked really well in World War I. It was just incredible that these ships, these tankers, kept sailing singly across the Gulf of Mexico and got blown up just one after the other.
From the point of view of the British, it was particularly galling because we had successfully convoyed ships across the Atlantic only to see them sunk when they were running down the American coast under the alleged protection of the United States Navy. And in particular, we were losing a lot of tankers that way. And of course, tankers, fuel oil, fuel petrol, was absolutely vital to the British war effort.
The six-month disaster that took place along the east coast of the United States, in the Gulf of Mexico, and in the Caribbean could have been averted in great part if Admiral King, who held all of the strings of anti-submarine warfare in his own personal hands, had done a number of things. First, if he had heeded British intelligence that was reaching him each day from the Admiralty in London, and if he had heeded British tactical doctrine for fighting U-boats, hard-earned knowledge that the British gave Admiral King and his subordinates. But Admiral King did not heed either, because he was an Anglophobe. He detested the Royal Navy, and particularly its intelligence.
And he simply refused to accept the idea of convoy on the ridiculous ground that this was really defensive warfare. But of course, as the British had learnt the hard way, convoy actually is offensive as well, because the U-boats have to go to the convoys, then you've got a chance of sinking them.
The second thing he could have done and did not was to turn out the lights. He decided to order that the lights be dimmed, but not blacked out. And so the massacre continued. As the U-boat commander said, even with the dim out, we're able to see our silhouettes very clearly.
Admiral King finally responded to the catastrophe off America's shores. Hundreds of small boats, schooners, shrimpers, and even private yachts were requisitioned to patrol U.S. coastal waters. To man these ships, the Coast Guard Auxiliary was formed. An early recruit was Charles Stamey.
There were no physical, no experience necessary, no qualifications. If you were breathing, you were in, period. In fact, all of these Coast Guard auxiliary boats, they didn't have any navigation equipment at all, nothing. There was nobody on that boat that could tell at any time exactly where we were. Nothing. If you saw something happened out there, you could radio into the Navy base there at Galveston and say, hey, you know, here's what's going on. Well, and where are you? And about the only thing you could tell them is, beats the hell out of me.
Another recruit sent out to confront the U-boats was Walter Daigle.
The ship I was on was a two-mast schooner. We had a diesel engine besides the sails. We were given pictures of German U-boats, so we had an idea what one looked like. We would go out 12 miles. And we patrolled the Gulf, Mexico, and we spent our time scanning the horizon with binoculars for several days at a time before we returned to Pier 12 in Galveston.
Initially, we had three boats in that auxiliary. These boats had a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on the deck up front, and it had four ash cans, commonly called depth charges, that were on racks, and that was it. If we dropped one of those depth charges, I don't think we could get up enough speed of the boat to get away from the explosion, so you blow yourself out of the water.
What would have happened if we saw a U-boat? We would have attacked it immediately. That was our goal. I'm sure we would have did that. We were to fire depth charges. What would happen after that, I have no idea.
It was suicide. If you went out and challenged one of those big German submarines, it would be like challenging a battleship in a rowboat. They would probably have used the deck gun and just sunk us right there. That would have been the end of it.
Passengers board a ferry near Cape Hatteras on the North Carolina coast. Their destination, Ocracoke, a remote island on the Outer Banks. Wartime residents have their own special memories of the U-boat war. Arnold Tolson.
I was in the Coast Guard, chief petty officer in charge of the 83-367, the sub chaser. Our main duties was to protect the shipping up and down our coast. In fact, we were all after German subs. You could come beside one ship and count 15, 16 more stacked at one time in the ocean, which had been torpedoed. It was a bad, bad time. His Majesty's ships come over and helped us patrol this coast, trying to rid the coast of the submarines and the menace. And that was one of the reasons that the HMS Bedfordshire was over here. Her and several of her sister ships come over to help us protect our coast.
We did not have in this country, we didn't have any anti-submarine fleet capable of doing the job. HMS Bedfordshire was one of a fleet of British anti-submarine vessels that came over to answer a very desperate call from the U.S. Navy for assistance against the submarine sinkings, which were reaching a crescendo in March and April of 1942.
The Bedfordshire was one of 24 that went across to the States. We sailed down to Norfolk, Virginia, then down to Morehead City, which was our base. And we worked from there, convoying, escorting, and patrolling.
In May 1942, HMS Bedfordshire was U-boat hunting off Ocracoke when tragedy struck.
That night, on May the 11th, we were tied up to the dock at the Coast Guard station. It was an awful boom. It shook the island. And just a minute or two later, there were another one. And that one got my curiosity up for to come over here the next morning and look and see if I could find out what happened or see what was along the shore or what have you.
Arnold was to recover four bodies from the ocean. There were no survivors from the Bedfordshire, but there was one miraculous escape. The night before the Bedfordshire sailed, Sam Nutt had been picked up by the Morehead City police and detained.
I never did know what the Americans were going to charge me with. I spent a day and a night in cells. And they let us out, and the American soldiers took us down to the dock to join the Bedfordshire. But she'd gone to sea. We had to go aboard another boat to go look for the Bedfordshire. They was going to take us out to join the ship at sea. But when we got there, there was no trace of her at all.
It was assumed the Bedfordshire had been the victim of a U-boat attack. This was confirmed after the war, in the captured patrol diary of U-558, she had sunk the Bedfordshire with one of her torpedoes.
There's a tremendous outburst of compassion on the part of the local citizenry hereabouts. These residents of this rather isolated island, they all recognize the fact that these chaps had given their lives in defense of, in effect, the United States at the time. And they are the ones who suddenly take this to heart and say, we're going to take care of it.
They did, and they continue to do so. The residents of Ocracoke created this corner of a Carolinan field that is forever England. It's a measure of the deep affection felt by a small American community for the crew of an obscure little ship became a casualty of the U-boat war, far from home.
I think they were a damn good crowd. They were also a good bunch of lads. We could always replace a ship, but not 37 men. Why I commonly miss that boat is there again is another story only them up there can answer, I presume.
The Bedfordshire's loss was not in vain. The lessons taught by those 24 anti-submarine trawlers sent by Winston Churchill and Admiral King's belated introduction of convoying ended the U-boat mayhem in American waters.
When finally Admiral King was brought around to convoys, he then declared, "Convoys are the only means for fighting U-boats." He became a very determined convert.
He realized from sheer bitter experience with all these ships going down off his own coastline that convoy must be adopted, that it was the only answer. And in June 1942, he actually did adopt convoy, and immediately the U-boat sinkings fell away sharply, and the U-boat's happy time was over.
But it was too late for the hundreds of ships that had already been lost and the thousands of men who had already died.
With the end of the American happy time, Dönitz's Wolfpacks returned to the North Atlantic convoy lanes with a vengeance. At Bletchley Park, the British code-breaking center, disaster had struck. Early in 1942, the Germans had improved their naval Enigma code machines by adding a fourth rotor. Overnight, the British code-breakers had lost their means of deciphering the secret messages that passed between Dönitz and his crews. No longer could the Allies eavesdrop on Dönitz's orders to his boats or pinpoint their positions. Bletchley was blind.
They were obviously going to concentrate on the convoys again and give up the American seaboard, or basically give it much lower priority. And we stared, therefore, in the face a problem which consisted of an unbreakable enigma, no intelligence, a known increasing number of U-boats. The German output of U-boats was reaching its peak, and everybody was desperate. That we were under much pressure from the Admiralty. Their liaison man would come down and say, "Look, you must get this U-boat cipher broken, because unless there are some ways found of dealing with these U-boats, now that they're coming back to the convoys, the country's going to starve."
Beneath the streets of Liverpool lay one of the best-kept secrets of World War II. In this vast, bomb-proof, gas-proof bunker, a massive effort was underway to defend the vital supplies coming to Britain against U-boat attacks. Western Approaches was the world's first combined operations command headquarters. Here, Royal Navy and Air Force personnel worked together, plotting and protecting the convoy routes across the Atlantic. On their joint efforts hung not just the safe and timely arrival of each convoy, but the outcome of World War II itself. Responsible for the air war against the U-boats were RAF Coastal Command.
The primary role of aircraft in the Battle of the Atlantic was to support the Royal Navy in their task of defeating the U-boat menace. U-boats were frightened about air cover right from the very start. The role of the aeroplanes was firstly to deny the surface to the U-boats, a very important role in convoy defense. Their other role, of course, was to kill U-boats.
By 1942, we had made considerable progress. Better aircraft, better search equipment, the introduction of the early marks of radar, the standards of navigation improved, crew training had improved, and the introduction of the naval depth charge had made a big difference in our attack capabilities.
Those attack capabilities were greatly enhanced by the purchase of American-built planes like Consolidated's PBY, the Catalina. Though lightly armed and heavy to handle, the Catalina's extended range gave air protection to the convoys against U-boat attacks further out into the Atlantic. Crew losses were high. Solitary sorties of 18 hours or more above the grey waste of the Atlantic took their toll. Mechanical failure, bad weather and human fatigue, as well as exchange of fire with the U-boats themselves, meant many planes never made it back.
Air cover was very important. From Newfoundland, the aircraft could come out 500 miles. From Iceland, they could come out 500 miles. In between, There was about a 300-mile stretch called the Black Pit. That's where the majority of losses took place. The German U-boats knew that. They always had a wolf pack there in the Black Pit. They'd string it across, and somewhere the convoy would have to go through it. My comeuppance came at the end of 1942, when I came out with a convoy called SC-107, 45 ships, and they got us in the Black Pit. They attacked for 72 hours. They sank 15 ships. And as soon as we got aircraft to come from the other side, the battle was over. They withdrew. From that on, nothing. We got the convoy across without further incident, but it was a harrowing loss and a terrible experience.
The very long-range Liberator in 1942 was a new American plane that alone had the distance capability of reaching out into the gap. One pilot, credited with more U-boat kills than anyone else, was one of the first to fly the VLR. Based in Iceland, British ace Terry Hawkeyes Bullock.
We were there for over 2 years, and this airplane, of course, could get out to where the U-boat packs were. The Germans were very surprised to see us, but they didn't know where these aircraft suddenly appeared from. When we sighted a U-boat, our instructions were to just go hell for leather for it and attack it at any angle. I devised a method where we could stalk the U-boat after sighting it and attack it either up track or down track at an angle of about 20 to 25 degrees across it. We used to have to descend to a height of between 50 and 100 feet. The lower you got, the more chance you'd get the depth charges within 10 feet of the hull to make sure that it was lethal.
The bombings from airplanes, they are coming on to you very sudden. Aircraft have come out of the clouds within seconds. They pursued you by radar and you didn't even know. Or they sighted you out of the clouds and you did not know. Then there was a roar and the aircraft flew over the bridge just about 10 or 15 or 20 feet above you and dropped a series of bombs or a series of depth charges straddling the submarine. If you were lucky, none of the bombs exploded below the submarines, or none of the bombs or depth charges hit the submarines.
My first successful sinking was on U-boat U-597 in the Atlantic. We'd been shadowing it in and out of cloud to get in the right position. Dive from a height of 1,200 feet, and I carried out my normal attack procedure. Only the bow of the U-boat had submerged, so we really caught them practically on the surface and released the depth charges at about 80 feet. That, to me, was a perfect attack. That was credited straight away as a kill.
But despite such successes from the air in late 1942, Dönitz was winning the tonnage war. Shortage of VLR Liberators meant the gap was not fully covered, and Allied merchant sinkings had climbed to a record level. The Royal Navy and her allies at sea took the brunt of the battle.
Especially towards the end of 42, things were very bad in the Atlantic. The weather was simply unbelievably atrocious regularly. The westbound convoys spread out due to weather. Losses were severe. Losses were greater than replacements.
During these horrific storms which we ran into, and the water sometimes was 60 feet above you, and next thing you were looking down 60 feet. But that sort of weather was ideal for us from the point of view that we were free from attack, because no U-boat could stay on the surface in that sort of weather.
On the Atlantic swells, which could be 200-300 yards apart, a corvette would ride up and over like a duck. You had every confidence in the corvettes. They were tough boats. But life on board the smaller escort vessels was grim in the extreme. In the mess decks themselves, they were overcrowded, grossly overcrowded, because of the extra equipment that had been put in for being on a war footing. Hammocks were slung side by side and touching each other. You had a constant wash of water, inch or so of water, with all the debris that had fallen into it, swishing backwards and forwards as you rolled and pitched. People being sick. Under conditions like that, of course, you had skin diseases to contend with. You had dobie itch, you had ringworm, you had even had lice at times. And quite a number of people in the escorts were lost overboard. Some even reckoned to have been washed overboard by one wave and washed back on board by the next one.
In early 43, we were attacked by a wolf pack, and for 6 days and five nights until we got air cover, we were more or less at action stations continuously. There was very little respite. You slept on the upper deck, you got wet, and of course the guns were going off. The depth charges were being loaded and fired. You'd fire what they call a box pattern of 10 depth charges. Two would roll off the back of the destroyer or ship, then two of the throwers would go out, then shortly again, in a slight pause of time, say 2 seconds, another two throwers would go out, and then two more would drop off the back, making a total of 10 depth charges.
For the enemy below, a depth charge attack was the most terrifying experience of all.
Everyone is white in the face. Everyone turns very, very pale. Strangely enough, people tend to look up to the ceiling and it doesn't do a bit of good. But that's where the noise was coming from. You can hear a destroyer approaching. You hear the propeller noise that goes pitcher, 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 pitcher. And then you hear the bomb dropping on the water. And then from then on, it's only seconds before it will explode. Is an automatic sense of wanting to preserve your life. Some people seek a different location in the ship, the control room, for a very simple reason. The main hatch is through the control room. They feel they probably have a better chance of surviving by being close to the only escape there might be. Everybody was encouraged to lay down, to consume as little oxygen as possible, because we never knew how long we had to stay down. At one time, we were under attack for 36 hours.
War at sea is an impersonal thing. You seldom see the enemy. He's distant. You fire guns at him. In the U-boat war, you might never even see the U-boat that you sink.
Now it really depends. If you're lucky and the depth charge is further away, you'll get shaken around a bit. If it's not very far away, the lights go out, there's a leak here, a leak there. That's the worst part. The attack from when the depth charges go off until the attack is over. If you're lucky, you don't get hit and you come back home. If you're not, you end up on the seabed.
U-boats, when they went down, they made terrible dying noises as they were crushed in the depth. And then you would get explosions. And all these things were indicative of whether you had got a genuine kill or not. We used to send away seaboats after we thought we'd killed a U-boat to see if we could pick up any evidence. Things like remains coming to the surface. There were certainly stories that U-boats would send up offal and things of this sort
to try and convince us that there were human remains. But the destruction of U-boats and the safe passage of merchant ships at sea was the question and the answer to the prosecution of the war. Unless the Navy was successful in defeating the U-boats, then we would go under.
That was close to happening. Allied tonnage sunk in 1942 by Dönitz wolf packs was more than the combined total for the three previous years of war.
In 1942 into March 1943, it looked as if the Allies were finally going to lose the Battle of the Atlantic, that the convoy system itself was going to break down, and that the seaways between the old world and the new were going to be cut, which would have meant no American expeditionary forces, no invasion of Europe, no defeat of Hitler in Western Europe. The U-boats were really unquestionably winning. They were hanging on the flanks of convoys for days at a time, sinking numerous merchant ships. They were really torpedoing their way to victory.
At Western Approaches, the secret underground headquarters for waging the war against the U-boats, the grim realities of the situation were clear. In particular, to the hundreds of service women working there, many of whom had strong personal reasons for wishing to see the U-boats defeated, Gwen Fethney was typical.
My brother was seafaring, and in 1941, his convoy was attacked by U-boats. He was on an oil tanker, and there were 12 oil tankers in that convoy. They were all sunk just a day from home. I decided I would join the Wrens because I was so enraged by all the sinking of the ships and the loss of my brother. He was only 21. We used to feel like putting the flags out when they sunk a U-boat. It sounds a bit ghoulish now, but it wasn't then, believe you me. We cheered for everyone that was sunk.
We knew that things were not good. By the signals that were coming in, the shipping we were losing, the aircraft we were losing. There was a naval officer who one day, it must have been the end of 42, just suddenly said, "We've lost it. We have only fuel for 2, maybe 3 weeks for the whole of the country. And the number of ships we have lost, there's no way we can possibly win this war now." And we were also fully aware that if we lost the Battle of the Atlantic, we'd lost everything. We knew what had gone on in other countries. Was it going to happen here, to this wonderful country of ours? It just couldn't be. I was taught a great love of my country, a great love of the people of the country. And all my country had gone through, all my friends and people I didn't know had gone through, this could not possibly be the end. We were British. Great Britain could never be conquered.
London, January 1943. Buried deep in the cellars below Whitehall lay one of the world's most secret hideaways, Prime Minister Winston Churchill's Cabinet War Rooms. This was the inner sanctum of wartime British government, the room where Churchill presided over the Anti-U-Boat Warfare Committee. German sinkings of Allied shipping had halved the vital war supplies coming to Britain from North America. On his personal transatlantic line to Washington, Churchill shared these grim tidings with his close ally, President Franklin D. Roosevelt.
And today,
the Battle of the Atlantic was the longest and also the most important battle fought during the entire Second World War, because upon its success depended the success of every other campaign in every other theater of the war worldwide. And if the United States and Great Britain were to invade, occupy Europe, and then the heartland of Germany itself, the U-boat had to be defeated.
The two leaders agreed on the severity of the situation and met in Casablanca for 10 days to address the problem.
Politically, the significance of the Casablanca Conference 1943 was that it put defeat of the U-boat as the Allies' top priority. And that made sense, because unless the U-boat was defeated, unless the Atlantic was free for the passage of American troops and material, there could be no invasion of Europe, there could be no defeat of Hitler.
While the Allied chiefs of staff hammered out a strategy, U-boat sinkings of merchant ships in the Atlantic reached record proportions. In the first 3 months of 1943, it seemed that Britain's vital supply lines with North America were about to be severed by the German wolf packs.
In the first 20 days of March, fighting Allied convoys, the U-boats sank 500,000 tons of Allied shipping. And in the British Admiralty, there was grave concern that they might be staring defeat in the face, because if the convoy system did not work, what could work to replenish the needs of Great Britain?
It really began to look at that point as if the convoy system itself would break down, that the Atlantic would be barred to Allied traffic, if you like, the losing of the war.
With U-boat production at its highest level ever, Dönitz's commanders were confident of victory.
We assumed that in 1942-43, the war could be ended by forcing England to her knees. We participated in some of the largest convoy battles of the war. The spirit in April 43 was rather high because of the successes we had achieved at that time. We felt we would be able to starve out England within the next year or so, and the war would be over and we all could go home.
It seemed that the commander-in-chief of U-boats, Admiral Karl Dönitz, through the iron determination of his leadership and the prowess of his men, had victory within his grasp. But the intrinsic nature of the U-boat war was changing in a way Dönitz failed to see.
The German effort during World War II reflected a rather romantic view of war, that after all, the human dimension is the decisive dimension, that men who are the best trained, with the best inspiration, with the most to fight for, will be those who triumph, rather than those who might have material advantages or numbers on their side.
The Battle of the Atlantic was not only a battle between the U-boat crews on one hand and the aircraft crews on the other, and of course the surface ship crews. It was also a battle between the scientists and technologists on each side.
The key player in this scientific revolution was radar. A new invention at the beginning of the war, confined to large land-based stations, it was rapidly miniaturized and placed on ships and in aircraft.
Many of us in universities were summoned before the war began to take part in the development of radar. The transference of these radar systems, which worked on a comparatively long wavelength of about 16 meters, to operate in aircraft was just beginning. One of my jobs was to help put the 1.5 meter system in the new Hudson aircraft for Coastal Command to use against U-boats.
That metric radar system became the invisible scout for detecting surfaced U-boats from the air and catching their crews unawares.
The planes came out of a complete blanket of clouds and detected us. They couldn't have seen us. They had to have located us by radar. Our leadership in the operations department didn't want to believe it when we reported it.
Die Reaktion war so.
The reaction from the person responsible for this, Captain Meckel, said such a small U-boat, it isn't possible that it was located by radar.
Despite this initial skepticism, the Germans soon introduced their own countermeasure.
They made a very simple receiver known as METOX, or METOX, M-E-T-O-X, and they were able to listen to the pulses from the 1.5 meter radar, and when they heard those, they simply submerged. When we became acquainted with this, the solution was immediately obvious: change the wavelength, so the Germans could not listen to our aircraft approaching them. The possibility had arisen of generating very powerful radio waves on a wavelength of 10 centimeters by the discovery in Birmingham by Randall and Boot of the cavity magnetron.
The cavity magnetron was one of the great scientific inventions of the war. Today there is one in every domestic microwave. This vital component transformed the ability of radar to detect U-boats on the surface. The centimetric radar it made possible was adapted for use in the planes of coastal command by Sir Bernard Lovell's team.
Within a remarkably short time, the whole of this was miniaturized and transformed through a series of really brilliant ideas by many of the young scientists who were working then. And within a few months, we were flying this.
Radar removed the surface U-boat's cloak of invisibility at night, the time at which it came up to recharge its batteries. But Allied planes, even though they could now locate a U-boat at night, still lacked the means of successfully attacking it in the dark.
In 1942, there was introduced the Lee Light, the brainchild of a remarkable Wing Commander Lee, whereby a searchlight was mounted in an aircraft and used in conjunction with radar, was able to illuminate a U-boat found on the surface at night.
I formed 172 Squadron. We trained the new crews to fly the Lee Light Wellingtons. The aircraft would pick up the target by radar, then home onto it, gradually reducing height to 250 feet. When the Lee Light was switched on, and as soon as the Lee Light picked up the target, it was lit up like daylight, and the searchlight operator holding the submarine in the beam reduced height to 50 feet and himself dropped the stick of depth charges across the U-boat. For the first time, the aircraft of Coastal Command had the ability to kill U-boats both by day and by night.
The new centimetric radar system entered widespread service in naval escort vessels in 1942. This Type 271 was the first effective naval radar in the world and transformed the ability of escort ships to locate U-boats on the surface of the water. But there was another kind of system for detecting U-boats that the Germans never knew about, called HFDF, High Frequency Direction Finding, or HFDF. It honed in on the U-boat's radio transmissions back to base.
The great contribution which HFDF made to the Battle of the Atlantic was that it enabled escorts to track down the transmissions that a U-boat was making in the vicinity of the convoy. If a U-boat had a message, if it had sighted us, for example, it would surface, make a transmission which started in Morse, B-bar, B-bar, B-bar. Now, we carried receivers which were tuned to that frequency, and the output of the receivers was displayed on a cathode ray tube. So as soon as a U-boat came off, it started to transmit, and that appeared on the cathode ray tube as a direct straight line, and this pointed to a gyro compass ring round the cathode ray tube. So the operator of the HFDF equipment was able to read off the bearing on which the U-boat was transmitting. All we had to do then was to gently cruise down the bearing, and eventually we would come to the submarine. either on the surface, or by then it would probably have submerged and we'd pick it up on sonar and attack them with depth charges. The contribution which HFDF made to winning the Battle of the Atlantic was enormous, and it probably has never been really recognised.
The contest between Allied and German scientists to invent new devices to confound their enemies had become a key factor in the U-boat war. So had the capacity to build these products. The United States' outstanding ability to manufacture a standard item in huge numbers became critical, especially in this tonnage war, where the enemy's declared aim was to sink Allied merchant ships faster than they could be built. In 1940, America constructed 54 ships. 2 years later, that number had grown to 746.
One decisive contribution of America was from her shipyards in mass producing merchant ships, standard merchant ships, which were called Liberty ships, in such quantities, because in the last resort, the Battle of the Atlantic was a war of attrition. Yet another enormous contribution of American shipyards was in the production of naval escorts, not only the small escorts, but also by the end of 1942 into 1943, the first of the escort carriers, which could carry just a few aircraft and which could accompany a convoy. And that meant that each convoy actually had with it its own air cover. And that was almost entirely American-built ships.
The introduction of escort carriers marked a new phase of the U-boat war, providing continuous air protection for the convoys from one side of the Atlantic to the other.
The balance of advantage in the Battle of the Atlantic lay with the submarine. Most of the advantages were his. If we could produce air power over the convoy, then that shifted the balance markedly. And one of the things that we did was to introduce the Mack ship, which was a merchant aircraft carrier. And these were standard grain and oil carriers, which are a rather rudimentary flight deck was put on, and then three or four swordfish were embarked on them. And if one can just imagine the North Atlantic in the depths of winter, it must have been quite horrendous flying these string bags, as we affectionately call them, from these aircraft carriers. They had that tremendous deterrent effect that whenever the submarine put his periscope up, scanned the horizon, if he saw the dear old string bag up there, he knew that it was carrying a torpedo, he knew that it had bombs, it had the ability to really spoil his day, and that was enough to make him keep his head down. And the aircraft would have achieved its aim just by flying.
Air power had achieved another aim. Increasing numbers of very long-range Liberators, operating out of Iceland and Newfoundland, had at last plugged the mid-Atlantic gap, the so-called Black Pit, where U-boats had traditionally operated with devastating success against convoys. By May 1943, the lines were drawn. A decisive battle was about to take place between a confident U-boat fleet, buoyed up by its great successes in March, and an Allied force with a rapidly growing technological and tactical superiority.
In May, in one of the most dramatic turnarounds of the entire Second World War, the experience level of the escort vessel crews and of the aircraft crews, and also this new technology, radar, airborne as well as seaborne, and puffed up, and aircraft such as the VLR Liberator, gave the Allies a technological advantage.
In early May 1943, one night our convoy was surrounded by 32 U-boats, wolf pack, and that night and a few days later, something like 18 ships were sunk, but five U-boats were sunk.
The U-boats lost 41 of their craft in that 1 month alone, and the Allies lost only 36 freighters and tankers.
Very soon afterwards, something like 100 ships came through with no losses at all, laden to the gills with munitions and food.
That proved to be the decisive month of the war. And at the end of that month, Admiral Karl Dönitz, Commander-in-Chief of U-boats, called back all of his U-boats in the North Atlantic convoy lanes.
We realized that the war at sea had
changed drastically, and we had to reconsider all of our options.
Dönitz considered those options not just as the chief of the U-boat arm. Early in 1943, Hitler had made him head of the Navy. He had taken up residence in Berlin at the Hotel am Steinplatz and continued to direct the U-boat war, though increasingly at a distance. Withdrawal from the Atlantic was temporary, he assured his commanders, a tactical retreat, not a defeat. Their Type 7C U-boats would be improved, he promised, and there would be more of them. With Hitler's approval, Type 7C production was increased to a record 40 vessels a month.
Headquarters was so convinced that one type of submarine, the 7C boat, would successfully complete the war at sea and win the war at sea for Germany. They concentrated on that type and never improved that type to meet the changes that were in the offing. Large numbers of submarines of that type were ordered to be built. When the changes came out of the blue sky, we were not prepared with new designs, with new submarines to meet those changes at sea.
Late in the day, Dönitz addressed these changes. This building in Berlin became the headquarters for one of the highest priority projects in wartime Germany. On Dönitz's orders, a whole new generation of technically advanced U-boats were to be designed, machines so sophisticated they would render all the enemy's anti-submarine measures ineffective. The Allies had their big secret too. Bletchley Park, north of London, housed Britain's top secret code-breaking team. Working quietly in this motley collection of huts and outbuildings, they had cracked the new German naval Enigma code at the end of 1942 after a nine-month blackout period that had followed the addition of a fourth rotor to the German code machine. It was one of the most significant achievements of World War II. For the rest of the war, the code breakers at Bletchley could read all the secret messages that passed between Dönitz and his U-boats. Despite the suspicions of some U-boat commanders that their signals were being read, their superiors dismissed that possibility.
The German cipher and signals authorities were so convinced that the Enigma was unbreakable that however many operational doubts were brought to their attention, they shoved them off and said, there must be some other explanation. You're dreaming, there's some other explanation. And a very big inquiry assured them that it could not be the Enigma. Due to this central German conviction that the Enigma is an impregnable machine, can't be broken. It could be broken for a day or two here and there if it's captured, or a few pages of the settings are captured. But continuous reading is out of the question. That's what they said. They start from that point, and everything else follows.
In late September 1943, the U-boats returned to the Atlantic in a new and terrible offensive. Dönitz was pinning his hopes on stopgap technology. The fitting to the Type 7C of multiple deck guns to shoot down enemy aircraft, an acoustic torpedo attracted to its target by noise from the ship's propeller. A steel gauntlet was once again being applied to the Allied throat. And for Dönitz, there were still propaganda coups. Flying 48 victory pennants from his periscope, his claimed sinkings during the war, Wolfgang Luth returned to Bordeaux in October 1943 after a record patrol of almost 7 months in the Indian Ocean. This made him the top scoring ace with Otto Kretschmer. He received Hitler's highest military order, the addition of diamonds to his Knight's Cross, oak leaves and swords. The trip was a remarkable feat of endurance and survival for him and his men.
The wonderment about how the little U-boats went so far and did so much, that's one of the reasons we have all the rumors that persist till today. How did they do it? And the way they did that was to get resupplied from these huge U-boat tankers or supply ships called milk cows, as they jokingly call them. And refueling took place in the Atlantic. And that enabled the U-boats to go as far as they did and to carry on as long as they did. The milk cows provided extra torpedoes, food, fresh baked bread, everything that could be needed. It even carried doctors on these that sometimes did surgery for the injured U-boat men. So they were just a vital assistance to the U-boats.
The Milch Cow was a purpose-built supply submarine. Twice the size of a Type 7C U-boat, it had developed out of the extension of the submarine war to the American East Coast in 1942. Sinking one milk cow, the Allies realized, would starve many combat U-boats of essential supplies. The team at Bletchley Park were able to pinpoint the time and place of their remote rendezvous through their deciphering of German messages. Armed with that information, American escort carriers were deployed to hunt down the Milch Cows and sink them. It marked a significant change in the U-boat war. For the first time, the Allies were on the offensive rather than defensive. Bletchley's decoded information was now being used aggressively to take the war to the enemy and hit them where it hurt the most.
We cripple the operation of U-boats at any distance. I mean, they couldn't keep the boats at sea long enough without refueling them. And we killed about 14 or so mother refueling boats. By the end of 1943, we'd almost killed our refueling system altogether.
This was a catastrophe for Dönitz. His hopes of a formidable offensive in distant waters collapsed overnight. Also, his new acoustic torpedoes had been unsuccessful. In November, he abandoned the convoy lanes as an area of operations for a second time, once again retreated to his lair to lick his wounds. Tactics, as well as technology, were changing the U-boat war. Dedicated groups of support ships were now being assigned to hunt down and kill U-boats. The leading U-boat hunter was the charismatic Johnny Walker, a Royal Navy captain. His support group sank more U-boats than anyone else, a record 28.
The essence of Walker was an offensive attitude, an aggressive attitude. It was not defensive, it was not stand back and wait for them to come, it was go for them.
As a support group, we didn't have to go back to a convoy. We were there to sink U-boats. We were there to hunt U-boats and to sink them.
Walker's strength was in total dedication to his job, total technical competence, and a ruthlessness.
His great innovation was the creeping attack, a deadly tactic against a U-boat seeking to escape detection by diving deep and remaining silent. While one of his sloops held sonar contact with the U-boat and acted as a controlling ship, another quietly crept up on the unsuspecting target, suddenly releasing large numbers of depth charges around it.
The end of January 1944, we went out on a patrol, and in the course of that patrol, we sank six U-boats in succession. On our return to Liverpool, the entrance to Gladstone Dock was lined with staff from the base. Wrens, there were hundreds of them there, sailors all cheering us in. And waiting for us when we came along the dockside was the First Lord of the Admiralty, Mr. A.V. Alexander, who was there to greet us. And he compared our activities, he compared what Captain Walker was doing to Nelson and the Battle of Trafalgar. They were sort of grouped together in his speech of welcome. Of course, we brought prisoners back too. I don't know what they thought of it when they saw all these thousands of people waiting to cheer us into Gladstone Dock. But a very moving experience that was. and one I shall long remember.
That joy was to be short-lived. Walker died suddenly of a stroke, brought on by extreme exhaustion, the result of his relentless pursuit of U-boats. His crew were devastated.
When Walker died, it became a personal thing. This great man, whom his thousand British tars in his six sloops loved, had gone, and it became the fault of the Germans. And I think it's difficult to dispel that thought even today. It was a different world without him.
It is all too easy to take a look at war, particularly the conduct of battle at sea, in romantic terms, or to reduce it to statistics, to think in terms of chess pieces moving across an ocean, however violent. But the fact of the matter is that there was intense human suffering. One only has to see pictures or hear reports of men who've been burned from tankers that have been torpedoed in a wild Atlantic sea, to see survivors dragged alongside, coughing out their lungs which have been filled with bunker sea oil, to see survivors in broken lifeboats who can never be picked up as the convoy goes by, and you know that that person will never be found again. These are the dimensions of war which are bitter, which are terrifying, which are morally repugnant. War is nasty business. War is about suffering. War is about violence.
He's gonna ram us!
Allied propaganda created a fearsome image of the Nazi submarines. U-boat men were cold-blooded killers in this wartime film, starring Humphrey Bogart and Raymond Massey.
In wartime, you have to paint your enemy in black and white. And for this reason, all the negative images which could be evoked to promote a hatred and a scorn and an anxiety about this weapon were used by Allied propaganda. Where the public perception has been that of brutality, acts of violence, or machine-gunning survivors in the water, the documented evidence suggests that, with the exception of one case where a military court found that a submariner had actually machine-gunned survivors in the water, that the German submariners were impeccably correct in their behavior, both in terms of the laws of the sea, these unwritten understandings of how people behave when they are at sea, as well in terms of international law. The examples are legion of submariners who have stopped to give aid to victims in lifeboats, give them water or some basic supplies, and give them a course for land.
Curtis was aware of this, and he really was very uneasy about it. He understood why his commanders wanted to do these kind of things, but he knew that they were putting the boats at risk. This situation came to a head in September 1942 with the sinking by U-156 of the British liner Laconia in the South Atlantic. On surfacing, the commander of U-156, a man named Hartenstein, discovered that most of the men on board were Italian prisoners of war. And he decided on his own initiative that he would undertake a rescue mission, not just of the Italians, but of everyone who had survived the sinking. And he radioed his intentions to Dönitz in Germany.
In the evening, the U-boat, which we had seen from time to time, overtook us. We learned later that her captain was a man named Hartenstein, who had taken it on himself to organize a rescue, not only of the Italians, who were his allies, but of all survivors. The sight of a U-boat alongside us, our arch enemy, was a very menacing proposition. And without meaning to, he put the fear of God into us.
A reluctant Dönitz agreed to the action, and he diverted boats to participate in this mission. They also got the cooperation of the Vichy French government to send vessels from their port of Dakar to link up with the U-boats and help bring in the survivors.
U-507 was one of two other U-boats sent to help Hartenstein with the rescue.
Dann bekam wir den
We got the radio message that we were to go to Hartenstein and take part in a rescue operation. We took the English, Poles and Italians on board. We gave them food and water, and we even let them have a smoke. With about 180 Italians and 250 English men, women and children, we soon got to the limit of what we could hand out.
During the rescue mission, an American bomber appeared over one of the U-boats involved and circled and radioed back to base for instructions as to what it should do. It disappeared beyond the horizon for a while and then returned. Its orders were to proceed with an attack on the U-boat, despite the fact that the U-boat's deck was covered with survivors and the boat was towing several lifeboats.
The Liberator dropped two depth charges. We were blown into the air. It was a wooden lifeboat, and the lifeboat was destroyed along with, I suppose, about half its complement. About 30 men died in that attack. Those of us who were strong enough scrambled on top of the wrecked lifeboat upside down. I remember being terrified of my genitalia and clutching myself. Absurd, but absolutely terrified.
The Liberator dropped further depth charges in successive runs. Throughout the air attack, Hartenstein had a white sheet emblazoned with a Red Cross draped over his deck guns.
All this time, Hartenstein and his U-boat men, who had reasonable anti-aircraft equipment, had not moved to their guns. And had they done so, the Liberator was in such a position, so low and so intent on its work, that I think Hartenstein might have blown it out of the sky.
The air attack forced the three U-boats to reluctantly abandon their rescue mission. The majority of survivors were picked up by the Vichy French boats from Dakar. Tony Large, however, spent a horrendous 40 days adrift in an open lifeboat before his rescue. Eckhard Schirraus injured his hand during the Laconia rescue and could not sail with his U-boat on its next mission. He was a lucky man. His boat was sunk with all hands off Trinidad. The two other U-boats suffered similar fates.
On the next patrol, the U-boats U-156 Hartenstein and U-506 Rudermann were sunk with the loss of all hands.
I have nothing but reverence and fondness for the memory of Werner Hartenstein, who was the captain of U-156, who would save my life and save the lives of many, many others, having done his damnedest to destroy us.
Following the Laconia incident, Dönitz issued a notorious edict to his men, forbidding any similar rescues, but Hitler wanted him to go further.
It is important to note that while Dönitz opposed any real actions on behalf of survivors by his commanders, he nevertheless actively resisted Hitler on every suggestion by the Führer that survivors should be shot. Dönitz directly opposed Hitler on that issue and said, "No, mein Führer, we cannot do that. It is against the honor of the U-boat service to undertake such actions. You cannot maintain the morale of an elite service if you order them to machine gun helpless people in the water."
Dönitz, as head of the Navy, now moved in the upper echelons of the German High Command. Although he remained chief of the U-boats, he was increasingly remote from their daily operations, and the personal contact with his men was fast fading. Dönitz had entrusted the production of his new secret submarine, the Type 21, to Albert Speer, German Minister for Armaments and Munitions. Until they were ready, however, Dönitz's crews had to sail out in their obsolescent machines to face the Allied onslaught.
We faced the enemy in 1944 the same way as we faced it in 1940. But because of the spirit in which we were trained, because of the strength of the German upbringing within us, we were ready to commit harakiri, just like the Japanese committed kamikaze suicide. We did exactly the same thing, only in a slightly different way. And all of our crews were ready to commit suicide for the Führer and for the Fatherland. Yes, we did. We tried to commit suicide. We went out again and again in our attempt to commit suicide because it was nothing else during the last couple of years of the war. There was no sense in going out to win the war. It was lost. But we couldn't tell our men. We could not even suggest it to ourselves. And we had to go on. And we followed what we were trained to do, to commit suicide. Most of us succeeded. Fortunately, I did not succeed. And I brought my men home. And I'm proud.
Dönitz said to his U-boat men, by continuing the fight, you are tying down Allied resources that could otherwise be used against Germany. And in effect, he's saying, you are buying time. You are, in effect, being almost sacrificed until we have the kind of U-boats available that we can carry on the fight in a new campaign with renewed vigor and strength through a brand new type of submarine, which will defeat the new Allied countermeasures.
But that new submarine was not ready, and in the first 3 months of 1944, Dönitz lost 33 boats. The one device that might have stemmed the losses, the Schnorkel, was slow in being fitted to the Type 7s. This was a breathing tube that allowed the U-boat to take in air and charge its batteries without surfacing. In 1944, Allied air cover of the oceans became so intense that a U-boat's chance of survival without this device was extremely poor. Anglo-American mastery over the U-boat was defining the course of World War II. It made it possible to safely transport by sea to Britain an American expeditionary force of 300,000 men and the millions of tons of war materials needed for the Allied landings in France. It meant in the months before D-Day in June 1944, the Allies were able to run 100 ship convoys to Britain without loss, but Dönitz still planned to redress that balance. Slipping quietly into the water in Hamburg a few days before D-Day on its first sea trials was Dönitz's long-awaited wonder weapon, the Type 21 Unterseeboot.
Type 21 was the first real submarine in the history of naval warfare. It was no longer forced to surface to charge batteries, but it could stay for extended periods underwater. So a new era in the U-boat warfare started. It was the era of total underwater war.
Before, their submarines had been basically surface ships that would occasionally submerge. They built a submarine that was intended to remain submerged all the time.
The main advantages of the Type 21 over the existing U-boat Types 7 and Type 9 were first the extended range underwater, the increased underwater speed, the increased diving depth for these U-boats, and, of course, the greater firepower, because they had 6 bow tubes and were capable of firing a total number of 18 torpedoes within less than 20 minutes.
It had a snorkel built into it, but it was built in telescopic, like a periscope, went straight up and down. And this Type 21 submarine was bigger, much, much faster. It could go up to about 16 or 17 knots submerged, and it could run on batteries for several hours at 16 knots, which is an amazing development. But the fundamental thing was it could remain submerged and could make high-speed submerged.
The Allied fear that the new boat would render all their anti-submarine measures ineffective prompted massive aerial bombing raids of the Type 21 construction yards in Hamburg, Bremen and Danzig, where final assembly of the U-boats took place. Despite the havoc this caused, by the beginning of 1945, 90 boats had been completed and Dönitz was planning a return to the Atlantic in a new March offensive. Meanwhile, his men still went to war in the obsolete Type 7s and 9s. In the final 6 months of 1944, Dönitz lost 112 U-boats at sea. Life expectancy for U-boat men on patrol had sunk to 2 months, and still they went out.
It is difficult to understand today that we did what we did. And yet we did it without questioning, without asking. We did it because we were trained to do it. We were brought up in a rigid society that knew nothing else but to obey an order, whether the order was right or wrong. The losses at sea were quite obvious, especially when you were out on a mission. You could hear of their last message. It was a standing order to send a message, if you could, of your own demise. And when we came back to port, we found that our pens were deserted. So you realize that the losses were extraordinary, but you try to avoid thinking about it. It was quite obvious that the intent was to send our men out to die at sea.
Dönitz gave a speech once where he spoke of the fanatical willingness to die. Of the fanatical willingness to die. And these young people had been imbued with this. It was clear to them that their chances out there weren't great, but they were nevertheless willing to die.
As far as the Navy was concerned, service itself was an end in itself. Service for the fatherland was an end in itself, irrespective of whether the National Socialist Workers' Party was at the helm or any other party that they could have imagined.
Political ideology, it would seem, played a minor role in life aboard a U-boat.
There were individuals on board a particular U-boat who might be known to be an enthusiastic Nazi, and typically people would know what to talk about around him or what to avoid. That you really didn't have this kind of politicization of a U-boat crewman that some people seem to think did occur. The fact that they were such efficient fighters, the fact that they put up with the losses they did, make them appear to be fanatical. And yet all of my experiences, both with individuals and with primary source documentation, does not support that contention at all.
At Winston Churchill's secret underground headquarters in London, the scene of so many uncertain moments in the U-boat war, a new confidence prevailed. At the heart of Allied success lay that great transatlantic partnership of Churchill and Roosevelt, and their joint determination for 5.5 years that the goods would be delivered and the rattlesnakes of the sea would be vanquished. The success of the Normandy landings, the re-establishing of the Western Front, and the clearing of the way for an eventual invasion of Germany itself all stemmed from the defeat of Dönitz's U-boats in the Atlantic,
and his failure to sever those vital supply lines between Britain and North America. By March 1945, Dönitz's plans for a new offensive with the Type 21 had crumbled. The Russian army had taken Danzig. Western allies had crossed the Rhine and were mounting devastating bombing raids on Bremen and Hamburg. At the end of April 1945, following Hitler's suicide, Dönitz became German head of state and began to negotiate the nation's unconditional surrender. On the 4th of May, he sent out a special message to his beloved U-boats. Undefeated and spotless, you lay down your arms after a heroic battle without equal. A continuation of our fight is no longer possible.
It is an index of the U-boat crew morale that on the last day of the war, in May 1945, there were still 43 U-boats at sea looking for targets.
They were stunned by Dönitz's order, some believing it was a hoax by the Allies. But the majority surrendered immediately, a few in American waters off New Jersey and Maine, but the majority around the British Isles. Over 1,150 U-boats had been built during World War II. At the war's end, almost 800 had been sunk or destroyed. The U-boat crews came ashore for the last time, their iron discipline intact.
The majority of the U-boats which surrendered were moored either at Lissahalley in Northern Ireland or at Cairn Ryan in the southwest of Scotland. At Lissahalley we had between 45 and 55, and they were moored in trops of five or six abreast. The main work of maintaining them was carried out by German crews. They sang vigorously as they were marched down in the mornings to the boats, and quite likely sang again as they came back to their quarters. They still regarded their U-boats as theirs. They were proud of them and wanted to see that they were maintained to the necessary standards. The major Allied governments, United States, United Kingdom, and Russia, agreed that they would each be entitled to take six U-boats and that the remainder would be scuttled in the North Atlantic in deep water. The main object was to dispose of them so that they could not be used offensively again by any country.
In Operation Deadlight, the Royal Navy and Air Force used the remnants of the once mighty fleet for target practice. It was the end of Dönitz's iron coffins. Dönitz was tried by the Allies at Nuremberg and sent to Spandau prison for 10 years. He served his full sentence and was released in 1956. When he died on Christmas Eve, 1980, he was refused a state funeral by the German government. He lies buried with his wife and two sons, both of whom were killed at sea during the war, in this village cemetery near Hamburg. And what of those who served their beloved Grand Admiral so loyally?
The U-boat effort was undertaken with such faith, with such zeal, with such superhuman effort, that these men waged a campaign of unbelievable exertion of energy and will and morale. The losses they suffered were so horrific. 32,000 killed or captured out of a total force of 40,000. A rate loss that's matched only by the kamikazes in the Pacific during the end of World War II. And yet they were still able to perform. They were still fighting up to the last day. And in the end, it was for a regime that represented what? Auschwitz, Buchenwald. And that, I think, has been the difficulty that U-boat submariners, that U-boat crewmen today still have to deal with.
The
the last of the iron coffins completes a long sea journey. Its final resting place, ironically, is Liverpool, the city that masterminded the U-boat's defeat, where it is to go on public display. It comes not as a trophy of war, but as a reminder to future generations of the fearsome threat the U-boats posed. Above all, it is a lasting testimony to the courage, fortitude, and sacrifice of the thousands of individuals on the Allied side, whose united efforts eventually ensured the U-boat's decisive and very necessary defeat.